Popular meningitis patients, Badouri and Banerjee, documented low blood levels of vitamin C. Abbasi et al. Also showed that the vitamin C status in tuberculosis appeared to directly correlate with the activity level of the disease. Looking at the urinary excretion levels of vitamin C, they found that 23 cases of active tuberculosis had low levels of excretion. 46 cases of clinically inactive tuberculosis had normal excretion levels, and 19 cases deemed to be half-active clinically had intermediate readings. These observations can also be interpreted to indicate that vitamin C status in the body is actually what determines whether active tuberculosis ever evolves to the inactive or latent state. Heise and Martin were able to correlate the daily urinary excretion of vitamin C with the activity level of the tuberculosis infection. By looking at patient X-rays, they found that the lowest levels of urinary vitamin C, indicating low body levels, were associated with the greatest disease activity. Awotedu et al. Demonstrated that patients with pulmonary tuberculosis have significantly lower plasma vitamin C levels than the normal population. Furthermore, they were able to find a correlation between the low plasma vitamin C levels and extensiveness of the lung disease on X-ray. The ability of vitamin C to decrease the likelihood of contracting tuberculosis has also been examined. Downs found that a daily supplementation of vitamins and minerals that included vitamin C resulted in an appreciably lower incidence of new cases of tuberculosis in a treated group of people when compared to a control group not receiving the supplementation. Nevertheless, Downs was not convinced the study had statistical significance. Goetz et al. Provided good statistical evidence that one's vitamin C level is a very significant indicator of the susceptibility to new tuberculosis infection. They looked at a group of 1,100 men who were free of pulmonary tuberculosis when first examined. Over the next 7 years, 28 of these men developed X-ray evidence of pulmonary tuberculosis. By looking at previously gathered data, all 28 cases of tuberculosis had demonstrated low plasma levels of vitamin C. Furthermore, the cases of clearly active tuberculosis had markedly substandard levels of both vitamin C and vitamin A. Himila et al. Found that individuals who had a dietary vitamin C intake greater than merely 90 milligrams daily and who consumed more than the average amount of fruits, vegetables, and berries had a significantly lower risk of contracting tuberculosis. In animal studies, the evidence for vitamin C's ability to prevent tuberculosis infections is compelling as well. In both susceptible people and animals, the swallowing of sputum with tuberculosis bacteria coming from an already existing pulmonary infection can lead to tuberculosis infection in the intestines. McConkie and Smith conducted an experiment that can be interpreted as indicating that it is the vitamin C level in the body that determines the likelihood of contracting intestinal tuberculosis. They fed guinea pigs tuberculosis sputum for periods ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. Of the 37 animals maintained on a diet partially deficient in vitamin C, 36 developed ulcerative intestinal tuberculosis. Furthermore, in the 35 animals supplemented with an adequate amount of vitamin C, only 2 animals developed this intestinal infection. Birkhaug published a series of studies looking at the role vitamin C plays in the tuberculosis disease process in guinea pigs. He was able to demonstrate a significant and progressive deficiency of vitamin C in guinea pigs infected with tuberculosis. He also found that a significant vitamin C deficit developed in the adrenal glands of infected animals. The adrenal glands are tissues that especially concentrate vitamin C in the normal animal. Birkhaug also noted some blood changes in vitamin C-treated tuberculosis guinea pigs that approximated the changes seen in similarly treated humans with tuberculosis. Over a period of 7 weeks of treatment, the red blood cell counts and hemoglobin levels in treated guinea pigs increased slightly, and white blood cell counts became more normal in the same group. The overall effect of vitamin C administration on the clinical course of tuberculosis in the guinea pigs was evaluated as well. Bierkaug determined that 10 milligrams of vitamin C daily caused a significant weight gain, accompanied by a reduction in the development of a more generalized tubercular infection, which indicates a reduction in the clinical invasiveness of tuberculous lesions. Since tuberculosis was once known as consumption because it involves a gradual wasting away of the body in its advanced stages, weight gain is always a very positive response to a tuberculosis treatment. As early as 1689, Richard Morton made the observation in his work Tisiologia that scurvy is wont to occasion a consumption of the lungs, indicating that scurvy predisposes the patient to contracting tuberculosis. Bierkaug was also able to demonstrate under the microscope that his treated guinea pigs had fewer lesions, more collagen, connective tissue requiring vitamin C for synthesis, encapsulating and walling off the lesions, and less tuberculosis bacteria throughout the tissue. In other words, this dose of vitamin C, while not curing the guinea pigs of their tuberculosis infection, did show clear evidence that the infection had been made much more dormant and clinically less consequential without any evidence of active or aggressive infection. In effect, the infection had been quarantined within the bodies of the infected animals themselves. Grant also reported that increased amounts of vitamin C seemed to decrease the severity and extent of tuberculous lesions in the lungs of guinea pigs. This was likely due to a more effective encapsulation of the tuberculous lesions. Leichtentritt fed tuberculous guinea pigs large amounts of orange juice. Although this study preceded the discovery of vitamin C, orange juice was known to contain an unidentified anti-scurvy substance in it. The guinea pigs with this orange juice, supplemented in their normal diet, survived twice as long as animals fed only the normal diet. Also, the orange juice group was found to have encapsulated their infections, with a walling off of the tuberculous lesions in the fashion noted a moment ago. Those animals deprived of orange juice had a very unchecked, widespread tuberculous infection, miliary tuberculosis. Miliary tuberculosis is a very aggressive form of tuberculosis that can quickly result in the death of the infected person or animal if not promptly brought under control. Hoyer noticed an interesting microscopic appearance of the infected tissues in tuberculous guinea pigs also afflicted with scurvy. The sites of tuberculous infection in muscular, lymph glandular, or splenic tissue was neither surrounded nor penetrated by any connective tissue. Literally, the sites of infected and dead tissue made a direct transition into normal, non-infected tissue without any evidence of borders or demarcation. It would appear that vitamin C plays an integral role in the natural walling off and isolation of tuberculous lesions, perhaps largely due to its essential role in the formation of collagen, which is the body's primary connective tissue. Vitamin C has similarly been implicated in the walling off of focal sites of cancer as well. It is likely that vitamin C is the primary force in isolating and lessening the impact of any foreign or unwelcome presence perceived by the body. Even if large doses of vitamin C do not prove to cure tuberculosis, optimal vitamin C dosing would appear to be essential in allowing the coexistence of relative good health and a chronic tuberculous infection. Certainly, the aggressive and rapidly fatal miliary tubercular infections show little or no evidence of walling off any tuberculous lesions. This strongly implies that a severe vitamin C deficiency is an essential precondition for the development of this unrelenting form of tuberculosis. The present availability of oral liposome encapsulated vitamin C could prove to have an enormous impact in controlling and possibly even curing tuberculosis. Not surprisingly, Morican et al. were able to show that scurvy-stricken guinea pigs given oral doses of tuberculosis bacteria had a more rapid progression of the disease than in guinea pigs fed normal diets. Green et al. Were also able to demonstrate that a chronic vitamin C deficiency in the face of active tuberculosis resulted in a significant loss of body weight and shortened survival in guinea pigs. Heise and Martin showed that even though the tuberculosis infection was not eliminated, a 20 milligram daily injection of vitamin C into the abdomens of infected guinea pigs controlled the clinical course of the disease very well. The treated animals given a subcutaneous injection of tubercular organisms grew at a normal rate and behaved in every way just as the controls over a 5-month period, even though the autopsy studies documented the presence of tubercular infection in various tissues. Even more basic research has been conducted that has examined the effect that vitamin C has on the growth of tuberculosis bacteria. Boissevin and Spillane were able to demonstrate that an artificial growth medium that otherwise readily supported the growth of tuberculosis bacteria showed no growth at a fairly low concentration of added vitamin C, 0.001%. Mervick et al. Also found that vitamin C added to a tuberculosis bacteria culture medium was able to inhibit growth. They further determined that it was a breakdown product of vitamin C exerting the antibacterial effect in this system. Their research was stimulated by the earlier observations of Bjornesjö, who reported that the majority of urine specimens tested had the ability to kill tuberculosis bacteria. The conclusion was that vitamin C and vitamin C metabolites in the urine were the bacteria-killing elements. Tuberculosis is another infectious disease that has a toxic component as well, although it is not as pronounced and well-defined as other classically toxic diseases such as diphtheria or tetanus. Tuberculin, a sterile solution containing the growth products of tuberculosis bacteria, is presently used in skin testing to help determine whether an individual is at high risk of developing active tuberculosis. A positive skin reaction to tuberculin generally means that the individual has already had a significant exposure to tuberculosis and is capable of demonstrating an immune response to the now familiar products of tubercular infection. Typically, about 10% of such positive reactors will eventually develop active tuberculosis. This same tuberculin solution has also been demonstrated in early studies to have a directly toxic effect on laboratory animals, an effect that can be negated by vitamin C. Steinbach and Klein looked at the effect of vitamin C on the ability of guinea pigs to tolerate tuberculin, which in sufficient doses is fatal to these animals. Capillary hemorrhaging, a classical finding in acute scurvy, was found in all tissues examined in tuberculous animals after toxic doses of tuberculin were administered. Interestingly, they found that their regimen of vitamin C did not neutralize the toxicity of tuberculin when mixed directly with it prior to injection into the animals. However, they were able to show that 5 milligrams daily injections of vitamin C were adequate to protect tuberculous guinea pigs against otherwise lethal doses of tuberculin that would have readily killed the unsupplemented control animals. Steinbach and Klein later demonstrated a similar result, with 13 of 16, 81%, controlled tuberculous guinea pigs dying from tuberculin shock after a regimen of repeated doses. However, only 3 of 17, 18%, infected animals succumbed to the tuberculin doses when also treated with vitamin C. Birkaug found that skin reaction to subcutaneous injections of tuberculin was also significantly inhibited by the daily oral dosing of vitamin C in tuberculous guinea pigs. This skin testing is comparable to the skin testing used in humans to determine past tuberculosis exposure. Apparently, enough vitamin C effectively neutralizes the toxicity of the bacterial products in the tuberculin solution once it is in the animal. This effectively negates the need or the stimulus for the immune system to cause the typical inflammatory reaction in the skin, termed a positive tuberculin skin test in humans. Boyden and Anderson hypothesized that vitamin C reduced the metabolic injury to cells in the tuberculous host that is caused by the antigen-antibody complexes formed by the immune system's reaction to the release of bacterial byproducts. These byproducts are essentially what is in the purified tuberculin solution. This conforms with Birkhaug's observation that vitamin C lessens the reaction to tuberculin in sensitive animals and man. It also helps to explain why generalized miliary tuberculosis is so unrelenting. Severe vitamin C deficiency allows it to develop to begin with, and then there is a resultant release of massive amounts of bacterial byproducts as the infection goes unchecked. The final result is advanced tuberculin toxicity and shock that require even more vitamin C to counteract. Birkhaug also noted that the degree of inhibition of the inflammatory skin reaction to tuberculin was definitely correlated with the content of vitamin C in the urine and adrenal glands, which are two measurements used to effectively assess the animal's vitamin C stores. Beeling had earlier noted a similar protective effect against the toxicity of tuberculin by merely placing tuberculous guinea pigs on a normal diet known to prevent scurvy. Some additional evidence on a toxic component of the tuberculous infection was published by Kato. Kato was able to demonstrate that both live tuberculosis bacteria as well as the toxic constituents of tuberculosis bacteria could impair oxidative phosphorylation. This is a chemical process that is essential for the production of ATP, one of the most important molecules in the body, involving the production of energy. A number of other early investigators did not have the same success in the treatment of tuberculosis with small doses of vitamin C, as detailed earlier. Martin and Heise did not report achieving a beneficial effect using only 200 milligrams of vitamin C daily, according to their evaluation of patient x-rays, sputum examinations, sedimentation rates, and tuberculin skin tests. They also did not feel that the coughing up of blood by the treated patients was favorably affected. Yozevich reported little success when treating tuberculous patients with vitamin C doses ranging from 100 to 200 milligrams daily. Sweeney et al. Also reported little success when treating tuberculosis patients with vitamin C doses ranging from 100 to 200 milligrams daily. Irwin et al. Also concluded that a 100 to 200 milligram daily dose of vitamin C was not useful in the treatment of tuberculosis, although they excluded improved appetite and lessened cough as symptoms of improvement. Kaplan and Zonis, administering 200 milligrams of vitamin C daily for a 6-month period, somehow concluded that no significant favorable effects could be ascribed to this therapy. This conclusion was made even though the investigators acknowledged that subjectively and by X-ray, the experimental group seems to have done considerably better. Even the conclusions of some researchers need to be examined in more detail before being taken at face value. It is likely that the lack of success in most of the negative tuberculosis vitamin C studies relates primarily to the small doses of vitamin C used. However, whether the route of administration is oral or injected is another important factor. Duration of therapy is also important, as tuberculosis bacteria grow slowly, and the clinical responses to any therapy cannot be expected to be as immediate or pronounced as in a more acute disease. Tuberculosis requires years of traditional anti-tuberculosis drug therapy for optimal effects. Expecting vitamin C to accomplish in a few weeks or even months what no other drug can achieve in the same time frame is not a fair evaluation of the utility of vitamin C in the treatment of tuberculosis. Also, the stage of the disease will also play a role. advanced tuberculous lung changes with increasing cavitational disease and breakdown of lung tissue will also help determine whether a small dose of vitamin C can possibly make a difference. Such advanced active disease will generally require larger doses of vitamin C to show a definitive positive response. Finally, the increased destruction of vitamin C by the tubercular infection pushes the necessary daily anti-scurvy dose of vitamin C into the range of 100 to 200 milligrams daily. When the patients in a given study are less well nourished, this small daily dosing of vitamin C will likely just prevent only the overt manifestations of scurvy, rather than make an obvious difference in the clinical course of the disease. However, the terminal symptoms of tuberculosis and other potentially fatal infectious diseases are often the symptoms of scurvy. Therefore, only preventing the overt appearance of scurvy with very small doses of vitamin C is still of benefit in the management of tuberculosis. A little vitamin C is definitely much better than none at all. Overall, tuberculosis has not proved to be an infectious disease that is clearly curable by vitamin C. However, any prolonged intravenous administrations of planner-sized doses of vitamin C could not be found in the literature. Even though evidence of scarring at focal sites of tuberculous infection would not be eliminated by any regimen of vitamin C, the question of whether vitamin C could completely and reliably eradicate advanced tuberculous infections remains unanswered. Nevertheless, the vast majority of the research done on vitamin C and tuberculosis would certainly indicate that even moderate, suboptimal vitamin C dosing results in clear clinical benefits for the tuberculosis patient. The most aggressive forms of tuberculosis seem to be directly associated with the lowest body levels of vitamin C. Regular vitamin C dosing appears to convert active tuberculosis into a more latent, manageable form, where one's overall lifespan and general health can be expected to be normal or near normal. Finally, it also appears that tuberculosis, like many other infectious diseases, is an opportunistic disease that prefers a vitamin C deficient body as a host. Malnutrition, especially in the absence of any supplementation, is the primary precursor for contracting tuberculosis. Malnutrition is defined here only as a poor choice of foods with suboptimal intake of vitamin C. Starvation would also be a predisposition for tuberculosis, but such severe caloric restriction is not necessary to contract the disease. Regular dosing of vitamin C at nearly one's bowel tolerance can be expected to prevent not only tuberculosis, but also virtually all other infectious diseases. Taking the oral liposome encapsulated form of vitamin C regularly may well eliminate tuberculosis as a prominent worldwide killer. Streptococcal infections, curable and preventable. Streptococci are bacteria that can produce a great deal of disease and pathology in humans. Interestingly, streptococci are frequently found colonizing the skin and mucous membranes of people who are clinically healthy. Kelly noted that a wide variety of microorganisms capable of causing severe disease in a susceptible host, including different types of streptococcal bacteria, was found on the tonsils of all her healthy research monkeys. It would appear that many clinically significant streptococcal and other infections are initiated when the host's natural resistance to infection becomes compromised, and the normally benign bacteria already present take hold and produce any of a number of different disease presentations. Smith long ago noted that his guinea pigs were much more susceptible to streptococcal pneumonia when they were on poor diets. When fresh green fodder was added to the diet, the pneumonia incidence promptly lessened. McCullough wrote a review that noted the susceptibility of vitamin C-deprived guinea pigs to the streptococcus and a number of other infectious agents. All of the different streptococcal infections will not be covered here. However, rheumatic fever, which results from an unchecked streptococcal infection, deserves special attention, as it still causes a significant amount of disease today. Also, understanding the mechanisms by which rheumatic fever causes illness and responds to vitamin C therapy will facilitate the understanding of the pathology and treatment of many other less known streptococcal infections. Rheumatic fever occurs as a result of an infection with what are known as Group A beta hemolytic streptococci. As a delayed result of infection with these bacteria, multiple sites of inflammation characteristically appear in connective tissue structures, especially in the heart, joints, skin, and nervous system. Although rheumatic fever can be contracted as an adult, individuals in the age range of 5 to 15 years are most commonly stricken. Recurrent bouts of rheumatic fever are also commonly seen, and long-term heart valve damage can occur when these recurrent bouts of disease cannot be prevented. A bout of rheumatic fever typically assumes a prolonged clinical course, averaging about 3 months. When the heart involvement is more pronounced, the duration of a bout of the illness can persist as long as 6 months. Penicillin is generally given to eradicate any streptococci that are still present, even though antibiotic treatment has not been shown to either modify the course of a rheumatic fever attack or lessen the likelihood of eventual heart involvement. However, penicillin does play a significant role in lessening the likelihood of a recurrent attack of rheumatic fever. The streptococcal infections probably initiate their widespread inflammatory effects by multiple mechanisms. Many investigators feel that much of the damage associated with a rheumatic fever attack comes from the direct toxic effects of streptococcal bacterial products, particularly Streptolysin S and O. Rosano long ago outlined a number of different toxic substances obtainable from pneumococci, a type of streptococcus, that could promptly put guinea pigs into life-threatening shock. Many researchers also feel that the streptococcal infection initiates immune system-mediated damage, in which the immune system attacks some normal tissue as though it were a foreign invader. Another possible immune mechanism is one in which the tissue inflammation is initiated and sustained by antigen-antibody complexes depositing in the affected tissues. As will be discussed further, some investigators make a very good case that much or most of the rheumatic fever pathology is caused by a severe deficiency of vitamin C in those individuals with a significant streptococcal infection. Furthermore, such a vitamin C deficiency would make the patient much more susceptible to any of the toxins produced by the infection. Devasena et al. Showed that children who had streptococcal infections affecting their kidneys had significantly low levels of vitamin C in the plasma and red blood cells and significant increases in tests indicating oxidative stress. As a general rule, the more oxidative stress present, the less vitamin C present, and vice versa. Oran et al. Also showed that acute rheumatic fever is associated with a great deal of increased oxidative stress and increased free radicals. Further back, Reinhardt et al. Had already observed the low vitamin C levels in the blood of patients with rheumatic fever. Also, Reinhardt made a good case for the conclusion that both infection and vitamin C deficiency were necessary to cause the classic tissue damage seen in guinea pigs with rheumatic fever, which will be discussed later in more detail. Although no report of Klenner specifically treating rheumatic fever could be found, he did report having excellent results in treating streptococcal infections with vitamin C. Klenner stated that he had cured hemolytic streptococcus infections by administering vitamin C intravenously in a dose range of 500 to 700 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Cathcart reported success in the treatment of 3 cases of scarlet fever, another disease caused by the Group A beta hemolytic streptococcal bacteria. The typical rash associated with the disease is felt to be directly due to a toxin produced by the bacteria. Cathcart asserted that all 3 of his patients had a typical sandpaper-like rash, along with peeling skin, and laboratory findings diagnostic for scarlet fever. His vitamin C administration resulted in a rapid clinical response in only 1 hour. He felt that this very prompt response was due to the neutralization of the associated toxin by the vitamin C. He added that he had not personally seen a case of rheumatic fever, but would anticipate a rapid response of the disease to vitamin C. McCormick also reported success in treating several cases of scarlet fever. 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily was administered both intravenously and orally. McCormick noted that in each case, the fever dropped to normal within a few hours, and the patients became symptom-free in 3 to 4 days. Massell et al. Reported on 7 patients with rheumatic fever treated with vitamin C. Only 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C was given 4 times daily for treatment periods that ranged from 8 to 26 days. A 13-year-old boy treated with vitamin C had his joint pain completely relieved in 24 hours, along with a prompt lessening of fever. The fever was completely resolved after the second day of therapy. A 14-year-old boy, who had already suffered for many months, was also treated with vitamin C. There was a complete resolution of his fever within the first 48 hours of treatment. A 15-year-old boy, already ill for 6 weeks with rheumatic fever, showed a complete resolution of fever by the second day of therapy, and his other general symptoms promptly improved. Another 14-year-old boy with rheumatic fever and a painful swollen knee became gradually free of symptoms and fever during the first 4 days of vitamin C therapy. His elevated sedimentation rate also showed a dramatic drop. An 11-year-old girl who was acutely ill with rheumatic fever responded quite dramatically to the vitamin C therapy. She had a temperature of 104 degrees Fahrenheit rectally, an enlarged heart and liver, swollen and painful finger joints, swelling of her legs from heart failure, and a heart rate of 160 per minute. Over the next 7 days, the vitamin C therapy gradually lessened the fever and joint symptoms until they were completely absent. The heart rate dropped to 120 per minute within 24 hours, and swelling in the legs completely resolved. An 18-year-old male showed complete resolution of fever and joint pain by the 4th day of vitamin C treatment. Finally, a 5-year-old boy with recurrent rheumatic fever had joint pain in his right knee and both ankles disappear promptly, while the fever steadily declined until it was absent by the 8th day of treatment. Individually, each of those patients demonstrated a dramatic response to the administration of relatively small amounts of vitamin C. Collectively, the message is even more compelling. A disease that typically causes severe suffering for months was symptomatically controlled with vitamin C in a few days in 7 out of 7 cases. Even more incredible, however, was the way the authors downplayed the results, commenting that the observations only suggested the 4,000 milligram daily dose of vitamin C had anti-rheumatic activity, and that no final assessments can yet be made regarding the possible therapeutic value of vitamin C in rheumatic fever. They also emphasized a need for careful toxicity studies, even though they acknowledged having no problems whatsoever in the treatment of their 7 patients. If one were to read only the conclusions reached by the authors in this paper, there would be little reason to suspect that vitamin C actually produced such incredible clinical responses. Even though no such official recommendation exists, this paper alone should mandate that at least some minimal dosing of vitamin C be given regularly to rheumatic fever patients. Glazebrook and Thompson looked at the effects of regular doses of vitamin C in a large group of students ranging in age from 15 to 20 years. Over a period of several months, a group of 335 youths received from 100 to 200 milligrams daily of supplemental vitamin C. A larger control group of 1,100 youths received only the standard diet at their educational institution without any vitamin C supplementation. The results were significant. none of the 335 supplemented youths developed rheumatic fever, while 16 cases occurred in the control group. Also, none of the supplemented youths developed pneumonia, while 17 of the students in the control group contracted the disease. Pneumonia in an institutional setting can often be secondary to a streptococcal organism. Tonsillitis, a streptococcal infection of the tonsils that often sets the stage for rheumatic fever, occurred in about 9% of both groups. However, the tonsillitis infections in the control group lasted longer than in the vitamin C-treated group. The authors also noted that the incidence of the common cold, as well as its average duration, was the same in both groups. The interesting conclusion that can be drawn from this study is that even minimal doses of vitamin C are highly effective in keeping streptococcal bacteria from taking hold in the first place, such as is the case in the initial stages of rheumatic fever and pneumonia. Furthermore, it appears that small doses of vitamin C are also highly effective in keeping the predisposing streptococcal infection in tonsillitis from progressing to the more generalized streptococcal infection of rheumatic fever. Finally, the results are consistent with the fact that significant viral infections, like the common cold, require significantly more vitamin C than 100 to 200 milligrams daily to produce a clear-cut benefit. Also, streptococcal bacterial infections appear to be very susceptible to low-dose supplemental vitamin C. Other investigators have also found that vitamin C can prevent pneumonia. Kimborovsky and Mokrov looked at military recruits who had contracted the flu, influenza A. Those recruits who received vitamin C had significantly fewer cases of pneumonia complicating their flu. Pitt and Costrini conducted a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial with 674 Marine recruits in a training camp during an 8-week period. Although their primary aim was to see if vitamin C affected the incidence of the common cold, they were able to determine that 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily resulted in fewer cases of pneumonia. 8 recruits who received no additional vitamin C contracted pneumonia, and only 1 recruit who took the vitamin C supplementation developed the disease. In reviewing these 2 studies, as well as the work of Glazebrook and Thompson noted earlier, Himila found that each of these 3 trials revealed approximately an 80% lower incidence of pneumonia in the vitamin C groups. This degree of lessened incidence of pneumonia is highly unlikely to have occurred by chance. Sabin, in placing rhesus monkeys on vitamin C deficient diets, reported that 5 cases of pneumonia occurred in a group of 25 monkeys, while none of 21 monkeys with adequate vitamin C developed pneumonia. In another animal pneumonia study, Hamdi et al. Found that lambs given intramuscular injections of vitamin C had 83% less pneumonia than control lambs. Multiple early investigators publishing in German journals also found vitamin C to be of benefit in the treatment of pneumonia. It was also noted that vitamin C was especially effective in shortening the clinical course of the disease. Schirmai also demonstrated that evidence of tissue saturation was necessary to obtain maximal benefit in the vitamin C treatment of pneumonia, although patients with typhoid fever and diphtheria were noted to improve on vitamin C doses that did not produce tissue saturation. Esposito looked at the effects of vitamin C on experimental pneumococcal pneumonia in mice. He found that a vitamin C dosage of 200 milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day allowed the supplemented animals to significantly enhance their ability to clear bacteria from their lungs within 24 hours after the infective challenge. Although pneumonia can be caused by non-bacterial microorganisms, bacterial pneumonia, often involving more than one infecting microorganism, continues to be a fairly common, potentially fatal disease in older and more immunocompromised patients. Several studies looked at the effects of vitamin C on pneumonia without identifying the infecting microorganisms. Slotkin and Fletcher reported on the effects of vitamin C on pulmonary, lung complications after urological surgery in elderly patients. One 73-year-old patient, who already had experienced life-threatening bouts of pneumonia following two previous hernia surgeries, underwent an extensive prostate surgery procedure. He again rapidly developed lung symptoms after the surgery, along with fever and rapid heart rate. He was given only 100 milligrams of vitamin C daily in divided doses, with spectacular results noted within 40 hours. Two other patients had similar post-operative symptoms, and both of them responded similarly. In a randomized, double-blind trial looking at the effect of vitamin C on the clinical course of elderly patients hospitalized with acute respiratory infections, bronchitis, and pneumonia, Hunt et al. Found vitamin C to be of benefit. Using a fairly small amount of vitamin C supplementation, 100 milligrams twice daily, the authors found that the patients supplemented with vitamin C fared significantly better than those who received placebo. All 57 patients in the study received their normal medication as well. Otitis media, a middle ear infection commonly afflicting children, is commonly secondary to Streptococcus pneumoniae. Ruskin reported on his striking success in treating such middle ear infections with vitamin C. Although the infecting microorganisms were not reported, his clinical success was consistent. In reporting on 10 cases, Ruskin noted that the 10 patients he treated over a one-year period all showed signs of improvement within 12 hours and had resolved within 4 to 5 days. He added that the results were too striking to even question the therapeutic effect of the parenteral administration of vitamin C. All 10 patients received intramuscular injections of vitamin C. Rheumatic fever, as with other infectious diseases, has been found to be associated with low urinary excretion of vitamin C, which is an indication of overall low body stores of the vitamin. Abbasi et al. Looked at 107 patients with active rheumatic fever and another 86 patients in the recovery and convalescent phase of rheumatic fever. In both groups, there was a significant deficit of urinary vitamin C relative to an uninfected control group of 64 individuals. Most likely, it is the continued deficiency of vitamin C in the convalescing cases of rheumatic fever that makes them so liable to have active recurrences of the disease. The authors posed the question of whether vitamin C deficiency is a cause or effect of the ineffective process. The most accurate answer is that it is probably both a cause and an effect of the infective process. The infective process will always consume more vitamin C, and, at least in the case of rheumatic fever, it appears that vitamin C deficiency directly predisposes to catching both primary rheumatic fever and recurrent rheumatic fever, and to sustaining the specific types of internal damage caused by rheumatic fever. Streptococcal tonsillitis and streptococcal pharyngitis, throat infection, are conditions that can precede the development of rheumatic fever. Callahan et al. Performed a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of vitamin C administration in a group of 868 children. The authors found that fewer children receiving the vitamin C had positive throat cultures for beta-hemolytic streptococci than did the children receiving placebo. The vitamin C administration was also noted to result in higher plasma vitamin C levels in the supplemented children compared to the placebo group. Kaiser and Slavin found an overall higher incidence of streptococci in the tonsils of children who had lower blood levels of vitamin C. Furthermore, the children with higher blood levels of vitamin C were found to have streptococcal bacteria that were less virulent, capable of producing clinical infection and disease on their tonsils. Specifically, 40% of the streptococci found in the children with the lowest levels of vitamin C were virulent, as determined by injection into mice. In the children with average vitamin C levels, 30% were virulent, and only 10% were virulent in those children with above average levels of vitamin C. The authors also looked at vitamin C levels in tonsils that were surgically removed. Not surprisingly, the tonsils with the highest levels of vitamin C showed the lowest incidence of hemolytic streptococci presence. The authors concluded that the decreased incidence of streptococcal bacteria in the tonsils of children with the higher levels of vitamin C in the tonsil tissue suggested that vitamin C had an inhibitory relationship on the proliferation of those bacteria in the body. In the same paper, the authors also looked at the inhibitory effect of various dilutions of vitamin C on the growth of virulent hemolytic streptococci. They found that the streptococci were completely inhibited in 21 consecutive experiments, while in all instances the control bacteria grew freely. Similar results were obtained with pneumococci bacteria, a pneumonia-causing strain of streptococcal bacteria. Narp et al. Looked at the growth of different types of bacteria in urine. They found that vitamin C had a killing effect, bactericidal, on the one type of streptococcus tested, Streptococcus faecalis. As with a number of other experimentally produced diseases, the guinea pig, with its inability to produce vitamin C, has been especially useful in evaluating the treatment of streptococcal infections with vitamin C. Streptococcal infections are often very virulent in guinea pigs. Witt et al. Reported that vitamin C deficient guinea pigs were significantly more likely to contract severe streptococcal infections that often resulted in death. Much earlier, Findlay had noticed a similar result with his guinea pigs. He found that scurvy-stricken, scorbutic guinea pigs appeared to cope as well as normal guinea pigs with small injections of pneumococci, a streptococcal bacteria. However, when the numbers of injected microbes were slightly increased, the resistance of the scorbutic guinea pigs broke down more rapidly than that of the control group. The control animals lived longer and had a more localized infection. Findlay repeated this experiment with hemolytic streptococci and was able to find a dose of bacteria that killed the scorbutic animals while allowing the controls to survive, demonstrating a probable protective effect of vitamin C against the toxicity and lethality of streptococcal infection. In rabbits, Locke et al. Were able to demonstrate very elegantly that an intravenous injection of vitamin C about 10 minutes before an intravenous injection of pneumococcal bacteria was followed by a substantial increase in the ability of the animal to remove the bacteria from the blood. In 7 of 11 rabbits treated in this fashion, blood cultures showed no bacterial growth 30 minutes later, while 9 out of 12 control animals not treated with vitamin C did demonstrate bacterial growth. This is a clear demonstration that vitamin C has a strong antibiotic-like effect on pneumococcal bacteria in the bloodstream. In guinea pig studies, Reinhardt and Metier looked at the abilities of scurvy alone, scurvy combined with beta streptococcal infection, and the streptococcal infection alone to produce the types of heart valve and muscle lesions seen in human rheumatic fever. They found that the streptococcal infection alone in animals on an adequate diet usually produced no significant lesions in the heart valves. In scurvy alone, without the introduction of any infection, definite atrophic and degenerative changes were found in the connective tissue, collagen-containing matrix, forming the foundation for the heart valves. In the animals with both scurvy and streptococcal infection, striking lesions of a combined degenerative and proliferative nature developed in the heart valves with considerable frequency. This terminology is especially significant since the lesions of rheumatic fever seen in the heart and elsewhere throughout the body of the rheumatic fever patient have been described as initial areas of degeneration, sometimes involving tissue death, necrosis, followed by an inflammatory proliferative phase. Presumably, one reason for the proliferative phase is to have multiplying cells help strengthen the supporting tissue matrix that has been depleted of collagen, which is the vital connective tissue that normally gives significant mechanical strength to the tissues containing it. Recall that collagen is absolutely dependent on vitamin C for its synthesis. As Reinhardt and Metier pointed out, it would appear that there is a primary degenerative pathological lesion seen in both human rheumatic fever and in scurvy combined with streptococcal infection in guinea pigs. Furthermore, several guinea pigs developed similar lesions with just the scurvy and no added streptococcal infection. Probably one reason why the severity of disease can seem to vary so widely from one host to another is that similar test conditions can produce different levels of pathological response to specific stresses, depending on the initial vitamin C body stores, which can also vary widely. Reinhardt and Metier also looked at the effects of another organism, Bacillus eritrica, injected into two guinea pigs with scurvy. Once again, some degree of the aforementioned degenerative/proliferative changes were seen in the mitral valves of both animals. When the same organism was injected into guinea pigs with adequate vitamin C supplementation, the heart valves remained normal. The authors suggested that infections other than streptococcus had the potential to be especially damaging when combined with a severe enough deficiency of vitamin C. Reinhardt et al. Also pointed out that scurvy alone would produce a functional impairment in the joints of guinea pigs. They found that the addition of streptococcal infection accentuated these joint changes, and joint lesions were also noted to be of a type consistent with rheumatic fever. Furthermore, the authors noted that joint lesions were not caused by infection alone when adequate vitamin C was present in the diet. Reinhardt and Metier and McBroom et al. Also determined that acute scurvy alone, without superimposed infection, would produce rheumatic-like degenerative changes in the heart valves and heart tissue of guinea pigs. Reinhardt et al., however, noted that infection alone, in the presence of an adequate diet, does not produce rheumatic-like lesions. Stimson et al. Were able to show that some guinea pigs kept vitamin C deficient would show rheumatic heart lesions while being given only the toxin harvested from a streptococcal infection. Reinhardt et al. Also pointed out that epidemiological data on rheumatic fever in humans gave strong support for the conclusions they reached on the experimental interactions between infection and varying degrees of vitamin C deficiency. Campbell and Warner pointed out that the malnourished or debilitated child is the one most likely to develop rheumatic fever. Certainly, such a child is more likely to be vitamin C deficient. They also noted that rheumatic fever has been a disease that predominantly affects the poor, another factor likely to be associated with poor nutrition and vitamin C deficiency. Daldorf, using capillary resistance determinations, estimated a 35% to 66% incidence of subclinical scurvy among children from poor homes in New York. Reinhardt et al. Also pointed out that the age incidence of rheumatic fever probably parallels the pre-existing body stores of vitamin C in the patients. The Cecil Textbook of Medicine asserts that acute rheumatic fever most commonly strikes between 5 and 15 years of age. Falk et al. Pointed out that children between the ages of 5 and 14 years of age require approximately 2 times more vitamin C per kilogram of body weight than adults to prevent latent scurvy. This is probably due to the surge of active growth seen during these years. The greater the requirement of vitamin C, the easier it is to fall short and induce a subclinical state of scurvy that increases susceptibility to rheumatic fever. Further evidence that vitamin C deficiency is a primary risk factor for developing rheumatic fever comes from the seasonal incidence of the disease. Rheumatic fever occurs commonly in late winter and early spring. These are the same times of the year when vitamin C-rich fresh fruits and vegetables are least available, especially for the poor. Geographic distributions of rheumatic fever incidence also support the idea that vitamin C helps to prevent the contraction of rheumatic fever. Clark asserted that in the true tropics, rheumatic fever is not seen. In such areas, even the poor and the otherwise malnourished still get most of their calories from fresh fruits and vegetables, and vitamin C deficiency is not a problem. In thousands of patients, Clark could not find one case of rheumatic fever in the tropics over a 30-year period. Clark further cites Rogers, who was able to find evidence of only one case of rheumatic heart involvement in the 4,800 autopsies conducted over a period of 37 years in Calcutta, India. In India, cabbage and a number of other green leafy vegetables are consumed frequently, and they are usually subjected to only minimal amounts of cooking that would lessen the content of vitamin C. Reinhardt et al. Further pointed out that the symptoms of latent scurvy and the pre-rheumatic or early rheumatic state are very similar and have much in common. They asserted that children with either condition are often found to have general undernutrition, fatigue, loss of appetite, loss of weight, myopathy, nervousness, and anemia. It may be that the two conditions are essentially the same, awaiting only a sufficient exposure to virulent streptococci bacteria in order to develop rheumatic fever. Finally, Reinhardt et al. Asserted that pre-existing infection plays an important role in the development of rheumatic fever. Although the streptococcal infections, manifesting as tonsillitis, sinusitis, and other upper respiratory tract infections, are most commonly associated with the development of rheumatic fever, other organisms have been found to be associated with the disease. Any state of infection further depletes the stores of vitamin C in the body. Reinhardt and his co-authors suggested that both latent scurvy and infection are necessary for the development of rheumatic fever. Mild scurvy with a severe infection, or more advanced scurvy with a mild infection, both seem to promote the development of rheumatic fever. The interaction of the two conditions assures an especially severe depletion of vitamin C. Furthermore, the authors claim that the extent of each of the two conditions would help explain the known wide variability in clinical severity of any given case of rheumatic fever. Streptococcal bacterial infections appear to be especially responsive to vitamin C therapy. High enough doses can be expected to cure most streptococcal infections, although rheumatic fever has not clearly been shown to be curable. However, the resolution of rheumatic fever is clearly accelerated by the administration of vitamin C, even at doses that are well below those utilized by Klenner in other infectious diseases. The evidence is also strong that streptococcal infections, including rheumatic fever, should be easy to prevent if enough vitamin C is taken on a daily basis. The associated toxins seen with different streptococcal infections also seem to be readily neutralized by vitamin C, making it the ideal agent for treating streptococcal infections. Antibiotic therapy can be utilized as well, but it is probably unnecessary in most cases. Leprosy, reversible and preventable. Curable? Question mark. Leprosy is another infectious disease caused by a very slow-growing bacteria in the same family as tuberculosis bacteria. It is a disease characterized by both low infectivity and great chronicity. In humans, the infecting agent, Mycobacterium leprae, accumulates significantly in the skin and the peripheral nerves. This leads to a variety of skin lesions and loss of nerve conduction. The loss of nerve conduction can keep the patient from having any feeling in the areas most affected, and this can lead to further inadvertent damage to those areas, since the patient cannot feel the pain or discomfort that allows protection from trauma. Serious disfigurement and loss of digits can result, giving the dreaded physical appearances that have long been associated with this disease. However, the long-standing theory of the total isolation of leprosy patients is probably not warranted, since disease transmission is not likely to occur in a hospital or ward setting, and years of exposure often seem to